as you know, we are always told that more people will have more than a handful of career changes or jobs in their lives. And also, in addition to researching which jobs will need workers and understanding what those pre-recession jobs are that will never come back, a lot of people are also trying to assess whether or not their job that they'd want to do would be perhaps subject to automation. That's sort of a new thing that people are having to look at more closely. We called a couple of human resource firms, and they were telling us that they really weren't considering that as a lens to look through jobs in the next 10 to 15 years. Are these companies really behind the curve? I mean, what would you tell HR companies now?
So employment companies and HR departments, two sides of that marketplace, seem to mostly be behind this. They're still operating from a traditional perception of human resources. The smarter of them, the more advanced of them, have changed themselves into talent management for a variety of reasons, some of which are probably internal marketing. But partly, companies are beginning to realize that working for a company is more and more optional. And what they need to do is make companies these delightful places for workers to work, which means nurturing their talent, getting the best of their talent, allowing them to connect to the places within the organization and the industry where they can best sort of manifest that talent. And that's not traditionally what HR did. It was mostly, hey, here's a job rec. Here are the things we require as prerequisites, or we won't even look at the candidate. And then we're going to slot the candidate into a spot in the old career fish ladder that they're going to have to climb, and that's going to limit what they're allowed to do and see and be and do and all that kind of thing. And a lot of those notions are flying out the window, which is kind of the good news of the new economy. And the bad news that you've alluded to a little bit is that I'm unclear, and I think we're mostly unclear, about which jobs survive into that next era.
So as you look out now, and granted, here we are in fall of 2016, looking out at the coming years, what sectors do you see as being most vulnerable to automation, just to give us a baseline?
The whole question is, of course, complicated, and sort of it depends is a reasonable answer, but really you can see a lot of things happening. When I started in tech was back in 1987, and I joined at a moment when neural networks were getting their second lifetime. We're now in the third or fourth lifetime, and all this talk about deep learning and machine intelligence, a lot of it is based on these neural networks. But what I learned back in 87 was that when you looked at a problem like handwriting recognition, it turned out that was really a sequence of problems. There were a whole series of finely detailed problems in there that needed to be conquered and then assembled together, that needed to coordinate. And I think that's what's happening now is that the geeks behind the scenes, behind the curtain, are figuring out they have enough data collected and they have enough understanding of how these things work that they can start knocking off task after task after task. So self-driving cars, for example. I'm on the side that, and I say this regretfully, but I think robo-cars and robo-trucks are coming faster than we expect. We're already seeing, you know, tests in cities and this and that. And it turns out that trucking is one of the largest employers as an industry in the country. There are lots and lots and lots of truckers. Now, if you've ever shadowed a trucker for a day, you know that what happens at the loading dock is really hard to automate. But the long haul or, you know, the drive on the freeway from A to B, that could easily be automated because robots don't fall asleep, robots don't need retirement accounts, robots don't time out from driving after a certain number of hours. It's just that their batteries wear out or they're, you know, they run out of fuel, whatever it might be. So trucking, I think, is a big one. And then as you move around, you start seeing other kinds of industrial automation, whether it's for agriculture or for other kinds of things. And here you have to distinguish between physical robots that are doing something like picking strawberries in a field or pineapples versus software automation, where a piece of something might then be taken away and be done by a computer.
So put those ideas into some job categories so that people get a really good sense of what you're talking about when you're talking about, you know, software automation versus having a robot do something, whether it be sitting there as a concierge or something else.
We've already been seeing a lot of automation. You know, automated teller machines replace bank tellers. And then when you dial any place, you mostly get sort of a jungle of press one to not talk to an attendant kind of thing. And more companies have realized that the more they can do self-service, where the burden of service is on us, the less it costs them to serve. The smarter companies then realize that they still need human attendance to give the human touch and to do the difficult stuff and to really build relationships. And that's good, but I think those companies are in the minority. The larger number of companies, the larger proportion of them are busy just trying to get rid of human labor costs. And this is happening all over the place. So name your service industry, and you can go down to maybe burger flipping, and there's, you know, McDonald's and others are looking at automating a fast food restaurant. But then you can go sort of up the economic ladder of tasks and look at lawyers and researchers and analysts. It turns out that legal documents and simple journalistic articles and all that are already being processed by AI or machine learning of different kinds. It turns out that x-rays, once the performance of a pattern recognition system is better than a human, then why bother with the humans, right? We have to kind of look around and figure out how we're going to survive. There's a phrase here that's, it's kind of a techie phrase, but it's an important phrase. It's called staying ahead of the API or staying above the API. An API is an applications programming interface. That's the geeky part. It's what lets one program talk to another program. So if I have a medical system and somebody just took an x-ray and I send it to someone, the API is, hey, here's an x-ray. How much are you going to charge me for processing it and telling me what's on it? The thing at the other end could be human sitting, taking those x-rays and looking at them. Could easily be software. And I think you're seeing the implication here, which is once that API has been fulfilled by software and is simply more economical to do, that software replicates by itself all over the place, and that task, however small it is, has just been taken over. It's a hard thing to figure out how to stay above the API.
And maybe a very tough thing to think about what the future of humanity looks like. I mean, we've been given various views through science fiction, science fantasy, but also in reality, Stephen Hawking saying, you know, being very careful about what we're doing because of potential consequences down the line that would not only be unwelcome, but could be sheer disaster for humanity. As we go down this path where clearly we can go into certain places in the world and you can see an AI there, I'm thinking about in Japan where they've been using them for concierge. Also in a recent interview, Charlie Rose interviewed Sophia, also another AI, not quite perfect, clearly not human, but very much giving us intimations of what this is going to look like in the not too distant future. Are we simply making ourselves obsolete? What do we need humans for?
So we're rapidly making ourselves obsolete, and there's kind of a couple interesting things here. One is whether this new technology is designed to enhance human performance or replace human performance. So you could imagine x-ray vision and a bunch of other things that would make a surgeon much better a surgeon while the surgeon is still doing surgery. Or you could imagine a robot surgeon that entirely replaces the surgeon and is taught to do all the different tasks by itself. Now, you know, move this from task to task. There's a general conversation going on. I love this topic because it bubbles up to a whole series of very large and important public conversations that we're not having enough of. So I'm really happy to be in here with you on this one. I'm of the opinion that this automation software at this point, and I'm going to draw a dark analogy, but it's sort of like flesh-eating bacteria. Through every wave of automation in the past, whether it's from horse and buggy to the car or from paper and pencil to the printing press, all those transitions had an old industry and a new industry, and you could see a replacement of jobs, of categories of things to be done. In none of those other previous transitions was there a thing in the process, in the dynamic, that was busy eating everything the way software eats tasks. So yes, I think we're heading sort of into some crises, and our political attitudes about all this, like, what does it mean to have a job? Do we have any social safety network when you don't have a job? How do you retrain? Whose expense is this? Who suffers? How do we do this? I think those conversations immediately jump to the fore, because if we don't do that right, I think there's going to be riots on the street.
That's a very dire picture.
It is, isn't it? We actually don't have to go that way, but if you take a kind of an unjaundiced eye at the current political situation in the United States particularly, because Northern European democracies are not like this at all. Even Canada's not really like this. But here in the U.S., politically, we're heading right toward the disaster scenario I painted.
For people who would say, okay, how do we move ourselves away from that? Part of it is understanding, A, that it's happening and being willing to have that conversation, as difficult and upsetting as it may be. We've had difficult and upsetting conversations in past, even about things like intellectual property, when, you know, the legal system didn't know how to handle that. Your implications for how we handle the legalities of all the things that you just talked about is a whole other way of being able to view this through, you know, through that lens, which isn't seemingly happening either. So what's an entry point for this that you think everybody ought to be considering?
Sure. Well, there's good news and bad news on this front. The bad news is that we have an extremely polarized political landscape right now. It's not quite as bad as the run-up to the Civil War, where, in fact, the country split, you know, roughly down the middle, but it's pretty bad. It's pretty nasty. And the parties who control the policies, who control kind of the framing for industry and for everybody else to do things, are at each other's throats and won't even try having these conversations. The good news is that there's a series of strange bedfellow effects happening where libertarians and progressives are together on issues about a basic guaranteed income, for example, which is also known as a universal income. There's a lot of names for this. But the idea that you might give a certain amount of money to everybody directly without a needs test or anything else so that they can get shelter and food. And if everybody can get shelter and food, a lot of other problems fall by the wayside, because the moment you have a lot of unemployed who are homeless, you get a spike in crime, you get a series of second-order problems that are horrific. The bright side here is that people are sort of coming together on policy issues despite the rifts in the American political scheme. I'm unclear that a basic income is the way to go, but it's certainly a reasonable solution to the dreadful scenario I painted a little bit earlier.
We also see so many divisions based on race and class. That seems only to be worsening under that scenario that you painted.
So I just came from two different conferences here in Portland that were about underrepresented groups, people of color, and how this plays with technology and with a bunch of other things. And I have to say that all the conversations that matter are in large matter ignoring people who are poor, people who are underrepresented in all these places. Their voices and their needs are seldom taken into account. And often when they are taken into account, it's very paternalistic, like, oh, we know what these people need, let's just do this or give them that, as opposed to giving them access and power and capacity so that they can figure out for themselves what's needed. So there's certainly paths forward, but again, the way we see how all these things play out in our society isn't helping. I agree that race and class are tremendous issues right now in this topic.
As you turn your eyes to Hawaii, and here we are, we're not attached to ourselves, we are separated by water, we have to get on planes to visit each other, and we are a destination spot for visitors. We're also heavily dependent, because of that, on a service industry, and people here who are already finding it difficult to find affordable housing, lots of generations that have to double and triple up. And in general, people wondering whether or not they can even stay in Hawaii. Certainly a lot of, you know, younger people looking to the mainland for better jobs, and, you know, that will give them the income to come visit Hawaii but not live here. What do you see that's particular to Hawaii that you think that we ought to put squarely in front of ourselves, even if it's difficult?
Well, tourism is traditionally, and I think into the future, a high-touch business. If you were led around a city by a robot who, you know, just spieled the script every time you passed by a monument, I don't know that that would be as interesting as getting to know people. And things like Airbnb, for example, are letting people stay in parts of places that tourists don't normally go to. There's usually kind of a tourist hub where the big hotels are, and now we're seeing people disappear into all corners of places, which is great. And I think tourism will remain pretty high touch. The problem is sort of there's this other problem you mentioned, which is housing prices, and this is happening everywhere in the U.S. where there's a desirable piece of real estate, is that the people who are doing service jobs can't afford to stay in the places. In places like San Francisco, what they have to do is migrate way out to the suburbs and then spend a lot of money and time getting in and out of the city, but at least there's a place outside, whereas in Hawaii, the real estate is obviously really limited. So I'm not sure how that plays out. I think what you see there is more pressure to automate more service positions, and then public policy crises or underemployment or underprovisioning of services or something like that. But to find a silver lining, maybe as people are unemployed in trucking, they find employment in higher touch aspects of tourism, for example. And then agriculture and manufacturing, which are both really huge in Hawaii, they're going to go through waves of automation. So I don't know how many of those jobs will actually survive.
We have yet to talk about healthcare. And in Hawaii, as we know already, we have a doctor shortage, a nursing shortage. We have a lot of people who are aging. I think we have the longest live population of any of the states. And that looks like that's going to continue. What do you see coming our way in particular that might help to ease that crisis a little bit and that might be based in AI?
Well, healthcare and nursing are pointed to a lot. In particular, what are sort of called pink-collar occupations or care occupations, care work, tends to be high-touch work, tends to be hard-to-automate work. Again, one of the sort of silver linings of an aging population and what's happening on the other side of automation, which is the disappearance of jobs, is that there will probably be more and more work taking care of our aging population. Doctors should be seeing all sorts of amplification technologies now between diagnostics and tools and remote surgery and all kinds of things that at least enable doctors that are there to do more things. But I think there's some trends that might favor healthcare being okay in these trends.
As you look out over all of the things that come your way and that concern you deeply, as we consider whether or not we'll become an automated culture, what is it that you think that we should be talking about that you and I haven't yet talked about?
Well, to me, one of the ones we talked about that's of enormous importance that isn't a big conversation yet is whether these new technologies are used to enhance humans or replace them. I think that's tremendously important because you could do either. And I'm not arguing for protectionism of human labor, meaning let's cripple automation so that humans always have the work. I'm just saying that there's an intention about how people are creating these systems for automation. And mostly, as far as I can tell, it's about getting rid of labor. So there's a really big one. Then there's another incredibly important conversation that we have not touched, which is about education. And what do you tell a high schooler who's just finishing high school and just about to go off to college and trying to figure out what on earth do I study, what skills should I learn so that I will survive in the economy 4 years forward, because the conventional wisdom these days is that colleges are increasingly not teaching us what we need to know when we get out. And if you're a little more pragmatic about that statement, a lot of the jobs that will be available in 4, 5, 6 years we don't know about today, so they're hard to describe, and there's no curriculum specifically for them, right? Because things are just changing so quickly. And here partly I say, learn to run a room, learn to present ideas, learn to be a champion, learn a lot of human skills. How do you get a team to turn something in on time and under budget that really is a fabulous thing? That's a skill that's not going to go away, and it sort of translates from industry to industry. Learn to be a skeptical thinker, which unfortunately our school system has been designed not to teach us to do. And then there's a whole separate conversation to be had about the structure of our grade schools and higher educational systems, where I'm a big believer that learning is cheap and doesn't need to happen with the goal of certificates in mind, but in fact that process dulls our innate curiosity and our sense of agency, and that rethinking how we learn can be crucial. So if the state took this on as an actual mandate and mission, it could be a leader nationwide in rethinking how education works and giving people a tremendous platform for re-educating themselves into the new economy at pretty low cost.
We have lots of conversations about education in Hawaii. Hawaii has long been pointed out as being a place that doesn't do nearly as well as other places, and yet there are real pockets of success. But when you're talking about an overhaul of how we teach in terms of showing someone more of how to learn, how to keep that inquisitive fire, how to be able to motivate other people, things that an AI can't do, that distinctly human touch, that seems to be reasonably absent, despite the words lifelong learning and others that we hear. For Hawaii in particular, which has had real struggles with its education system, is there a place that you think that we've got to start with that, something that could be brought into the curriculum to be able to approach this in some way and then could grow? Because overhauling the whole system, a lot of people will hear that and say, well, that's not going to happen.
Exactly. Well, I'm a fan of doing things outside the educational bureaucracy, meaning the educational system is poured in concrete. Back around the Civil War, between the Civil War and the First World War, we industrialized our educational system. We basically imported the Prussian military educational system and plopped it down and rolled it across the country. And now we think that that's the only way you can educate kids. And that thing is really buried deep. I am positive that in Hawaii and different places, there are interesting experimental things that sound less like schools and more like colloquia or salons or free-range kindergarten or whatever they might be that are already terrific examples of this. I suspect also that if you look into Native Hawaiian, indigenous Hawaiian culture, you will discover a whole lot of ways of learning and passing knowledge that are incredibly powerful and fruitful. Certainly sort of the Pacific navigators who would navigate without instruments and all that, there's a lot of learning that happened in those places and ways as well. So I think that the question is, how can you at least loosen up the regulations so that these experiments can thrive? And then later down the road, as the experiments are doing really well, the bureaucrats and the people inside the system will look over the wall and go, well, gosh, that seems to be working really well. Maybe we should do that. Because things like the flipped classroom and project-based learning and all that had to fight to make their way into the normal school systems today. And I'm very glad for those kinds of experiments. I think they're great. But as long as they sort of exist within capital S schools, those schools are designed to make us cogs in the machine, not to make us independent thinkers. The hidden curriculum of schooling teaches us to basically sublimate our knowledge and curiosity for the larger metronome we live inside. Sorry to sound so skeptical about education, but I'm actually an optimist.
Well, for a lot of parents, though, who are hearing what you've just said, and a lot of kids who are in high school or maybe even just entering college, the idea of studying something that's not necessarily going to get them a career that will have any longevity is a little bit scary. And for parents who are also keenly aware of how quickly technology is moving, the idea of waiting for anything that would be brought into a school scenario that might assist with making sure that, kids are prepared for whatever may happen might not be something that they're willing to take a risk with. So outside of school, though, there seem to be other places where a lot of that learning is taking place. And I hear you implicitly saying you got to go look for that stuff, too.
Exactly. And well, this, for example, there are plenty of tutoring and enrichment systems available for students who are enrolled in normal schools. And you could start there, for example, by doing different kinds of learning. You could just take math and start teaching math differently or science differently. You could take a sliver or a piece of this and experiment with it and see how it works. You don't have to leap wholesale into the new way of doing things. But I think, if I were a parent with a young child going into the system now, looking at the prospect of racking up college debt, which the banking system made sure nobody can bankrupt themselves from, so that's debt that clings to you forever, with no guarantees of employment afterward, I would be seriously looking at interesting alternatives. And part of the good news here is that a lot of enlightened employers are beginning to ignore credentials. It used to be that credentials were the way, they were a proxy for capacity, and they were the thing you had to have to even be considered. Now, a lot of the more enlightened employers, and I have no idea how many in Hawaii, but the more enlightened employers are in fact going, can you do this thing? And who will vouch for you and tell us that you know how to do this thing? And let's go try you out. More and more, we can test people in tasks. Now, there's a whole other trend happening here which we haven't talked about, which is known as the gig or the freelance economy,
right.
which is that work is being deconstructed. Work is just falling apart, and we're bidding out different projects. This also touches the thing I mentioned earlier about staying above the API, because that's what we can do. We can disaggregate work into a lot of constituent tasks and then farm out the tasks. We need a graphic for the article. We need the text written for the article. We need a web design for the article. You could, in principle, farm those all out to either some AI or some humans and compose a web page that's not terrible. That's kind of the world we're in as well.
So jump with me, though, to people who are now mid-career, and they've watched their lives go upside down, both from the recession and from automation of jobs and the great potential for jobs to be automated in the future. What do you tell people who are mid-career in looking at, having many careers in their lifetimes before perhaps they're ready to retire, if we're in fact told that we're going to have 6 or 7 jobs or careers before we hit retirement?
I know. I think the situation for mid-career people is good, but. And the but is that their worldview is probably going to be the biggest constraint. The market's going to be another constraint, like who's going to employ you for what. But if you think that a company should be hiring you for the thing you were doing 5 years ago and should be paying you an annual salary and benefits for that thing again, and that's the only thing you're looking for, I think you're going to be, you know, grimly disappointed. If you're willing to learn some new tools, identify what your superpowers are, market yourself through networks and other places as having those superpowers, and then taking what you've learned from being mature, meaning you probably understand something about running teams, you probably understand something about human dynamics and desires. Fantastic, because I've met some 20-year-olds who blow me away on those skills, but they're in the minority. It takes some living on Earth to gain those skills. So those are your benefits. But you have to suddenly be much more plastic than you needed to be before. You have to learn how to use some of this tech stuff and just play with it. And the good news there is that it's incredibly inexpensive to learn to use. It occupies really only your time. If you go to YouTube and search for how do I use Instagram better or Snapchat better or how do I blog or tweet, there are tons and tons of resources you only have to listen to and practice. So learning is cheap. Point of view, your mental framework, are you able to flex and learn, or are you looking for the thing you were doing before? That's to me the major constraint.
So you could be your own worst enemy.
Oh, entirely. And then many people are. I think I'm probably my own worst enemy. But I think we're moving into a relationship economy where we're sort of coming back into community. We're coming back into forms of trust. We're starting to understand again that he who owns most stuff isn't necessarily the happiest at the end of the road. And I would say that a really great place to go looking for wisdom is indigenous traditions. And people who are right now fighting really, really hard to preserve whatever land is left to them and to keep their traditions alive and so forth, most of these cultures have a lot to learn from about how do you maintain people in community, about how do you take care of the commons, about how does the world actually work. And if we confuse those things with the fact that most of us now carry a little slab of unobtainium in our pocket that lets us have a video call with somebody halfway around the world at zero marginal cost, a thing that sounds fantastic if you think about it 20 years ago. If we confuse those two worlds in a creative way with good intent, I think really good things happen. So that's the thing I would point to around and above and sort of beyond the things we've been talking about.
And I hear you say that's especially important for Hawaii.
Exactly. I mean, the context for indigenous cultures in Hawaii and all the Pacific Islanders, and there's a really rich traditions there. So it makes a ton of sense to think about this with care in Hawaii.
Thank you very much for giving us this overview, and we'll look forward to talking to you sometime soon.
I appreciate the time very much.